Good afternoon. Thanks for being here. It is my pleasure to introduce Ethiopis Tafara, the Director of the Securities and Exchange Commission's Office of International Affairs. He will actually leave that role next month after 10 years of service as the OIA's director and 18 years as a financial regulator with the SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. The SEC was one of the first U.S. regulatory agencies to address in a serious and sustained way the interaction between domestic and foreign regulations. The Office of International Affairs attempts to facilitate cross-border transactions through international regulatory and enforcement cooperation. It has also made the SEC a leader among the world's securities regulators in pressing for high regulatory standards and efficient and transparent markets. Tafara's vision and leadership have played a central role in securing that global position for the SEC. As the SEC put it in a press release announcing his retirement, he is a, quote, dedicated ambassador of investor protection, close quote. Much of his work has focused on the negotiation and implementation of multi and bilateral agreements, enforcement agreements in particular, promoting cooperation by foreign counterparts in the investigation and prosecution of international securities fraud. This is, of course, a task that requires substantial diplomatic skill. Under Tafara's leadership, the OIA saw a significant expansion of international enforcement assistance. It currently handles more than 1,000 requests to or from foreign authorities each year. And the OIA's efforts have aided cross-border asset freezes and the repatriation of ill-gotten gains. Indeed, many of you probably read about one illustration of that from last week. The SEC obtained an emergency court order to freeze a Swiss bank account that bought call options on H.J. Heinz Company stock just before Heinz announced that it was to be acquired. Tafara advises the commissioners on international regulatory issues, represents the SEC in discussions with foreign regulatory agencies, and advises other departments and agencies within the U.S. government on multilateral initiatives on securities regulation, corporate governance, and financial system stability. Under his leadership, OIA created a new division that monitors legal and regulatory developments abroad. He also expanded its technical assistance program, which has now become a leading training and support program for foreign regulatory authorities. The recipient of the 2008 SEC Chairman's Award for Excellence, Tafara received his AB from Princeton University and his law degree from Georgetown University, where he also teaches. We're honored to have him with us here today. Please join me in welcoming Ethiopis Tafara.
Thank you, Dean Mahoney, for that very, very kind and generous introduction. have to start off, as is the norm, for remarks given by those of us from the SEC. I have to give you a disclaimer and tell you that the Securities and Exchange Commission, as a matter of policy, disclaims responsibility for any private publication or statement by any of its employees. The views that I express are mine and do not necessarily reflect those of the Commission or other members of the staff, though you never know. That said, I'd first like to thank the University of Virginia Journal of International Law for hosting this symposium and managing to gather so many distinguished speakers from the legal and academic community. I'd also like to laud the journal for its choice of panel topics today. The recent financial crisis has brought about renewed attention to the differences between banking and securities regulation in a world in which many financial products no longer fit neatly under one of the regulatory silos. And at the same time, the SEC, among other regulators, is paying increasing attention to the plague of bribery and corruption that can accompany global trade, with U.S.-listed companies obviously concerned about how the Federal Corrupt Practices Act is being enforced. Over the past 15 years, the world's financial system has undergone dramatic change to its structure and principal characteristics. To my mind, the four characteristics of the modern financial market are its global nature and the resulting mobility of capital, the significantly increased competition among financial service providers, the elimination of differences between historically separate financial products, sectors, and actors, and the development of a large and relatively liquid, unregulated institutional financial market paralleling the regulated markets. These changes, as revealed by the crisis, call for a commensurate change in regulation and supervision. First, of course, the new regulatory framework must address the issue of increased systemic risk, while not suppressing risk-taking per se. This is crucial if we are to address problems, yet not undermine economic innovation. To sustain the economic innovation needed to drive the economy, financial capital must be able to take risks. As a corollary, we need a regulatory framework that provides prudential regulation for those financial intermediaries that are too big to fail. Surely the essence of our financial system is to let people take chances with their money and to enjoy most of the benefits and to endure most of the pain associated with taking those risks. However, if we are in a world where financial entities are too big, too indebted, or too interconnected to fail, we know that those entities will have the incentive to take on excessive risk at the ultimate expense of the public. From a policy perspective, we want to end up in a world where, in fact, we can afford to let financial entities fail if they make bad decisions. Second, we need a regulatory framework with better disclosure so that lenders can determine counterparty risk. The credit markets dried up when the crisis hit because nobody was able to assess anyone else's exposure. A major step in the right direction is the introduction of clearinghouses and exchanges in, for example, derivatives markets. We should also impose basic disclosure requirements with respect to financial products that achieve a certain prevalence in private markets. Third, the regulatory framework needs to account for the fungibility of financial products, actors, and markets. Many products, actors, and markets have the same underlying economic characteristics, motivations, or clientele, yet are regulated based on connection to an institution that can be described as having either a securities, banking, or insurance function. This leads to market participants searching for the path of least regulatory resistance and pursuing regulatory arbitrage. Although this is often in the interest of the regulated community, it is frequently to the detriment of consumers and investors. By the same token, we need to be vigilant not to pursue uniform regulation for the sake of ease, given that there are instances where the fundamental differences in the nature of securities, banking, and insurance, and hence their regulation, are legitimate and indeed important. Fourth, the regulatory framework of the future must be responsive to the fact that capital and market participants are mobile, markets are interconnected, and technology makes this movement and connectedness irrepressible. Capital travels in search of investment opportunities, which means companies, intermediaries, and markets can choose their preferred location. Preference is frequently a matter of regulatory comfort. As a consequence, we need to ensure that our regulation is optimal in providing the best protection for investors and at the same time comparable across markets. And this includes the enforcement of anti-bribery statutes such as FCPA. Otherwise, we will create opportunities for jurisdictional regulatory arbitrage in contrast to functional arbitrage. Fifth, as we consider reform, we should not lose sight of the differences between market regulation and the supervision of financial institutions. Insurance, banking, and securities regulators all historically have a common interest in maintaining the health and soundness of financial firms by, for example, requiring the firms to maintain capital reserves. And all functional regulators have an interest in enforcing the law. But there are also differences. For example, the inherent tension between consumer protection and systemic stability often means that enforcement activities of insurance and bank regulators are negotiated and conducted more discreetly. This happens because banking and insurance regulators are concerned that public enforcement activities will lead depositors or consumers to lose faith in the firm and possibly leading to a run on the bank or a dramatic reduction in the insurer's ability to distribute risk as consumers leave. By contrast, securities regulators tend to have aggressive and public enforcement programs, with punishment meted out in the public square, as it were. Indeed, securities regulators believe public enforcement actions are necessary to deter fraud and reassure investors in the integrity of the system. In thinking about the differences between banking and securities regulation, it's worth considering some of the issues at the heart of the financial crisis. Whether you ask an economist or an Occupy Wall Street protester, one word you will hear to describe the financial crisis is failure. Failure of financial firms, failure of the financial system, failure of incentives, or failure of regulation. While even now there really is no universally agreed upon understanding of what went wrong, everyone is in agreement that there was failure. And we are now seemingly obsessed with preventing all further failure. But a certain type of failure is necessary and even critical. When thinking about failure in the financial context, I'm reminded of the philosopher Karl Popper. Popper argued that there is a dynamic logic to scientific discovery, which entails an interactive series of bold conjectures, criticism, response to criticism, and further conjecturing. The logic of innovation in an economy is much the same. Entrepreneurs put forth the bold conjectures in the form of their innovative vision. The market, of course, provides the criticism. The product or service is purchased only if it effectively fulfills needs or wants, and the enterprise is only profitable if it delivers this product or service with efficiency. If the market rejects the entrepreneur's vision, she can adjust and perfect it in light of the market's criticism. Alternatively, if the entrepreneur fails to adjust her model, her enterprise will fail, and other businesses will fill the void. The possibility, even the likelihood of failure, is an intrinsic part of the process. Just as science evolves through conjectures and refutations, real innovation is driven by an interactive dance of bold ideas and the market's tough, pointed criticism. However, in the wake of the recent financial crisis, the world's regulatory reform efforts have, quite properly, focused upon the reduction of failures in the financial market. Yet, here I believe is a grave danger, that in our efforts to reduce systemic risk, we force financial firms to forego providing the capital that drives real innovation, because it is precisely this type of capital that presents the greatest risk. Traditionally, banking regulators have focused on prudential regulation, while securities regulators have focused on disclosure, transparency, and enforcement. There is little denying that the recent financial crisis, while involving all types of market participants, was essentially a banking crisis, although unusual perhaps in the number of non-banks that undertook bank-like activities, and certainly unique in that securitized financial products were the instigators. The pattern of crisis of the crisis differed from other banking crises only in its depth. Financial firms, closely linked to each other through leverage and counterparty arrangements, exposed themselves to too much risk. And when that risk became apparent, there was a run on these financial institutions. Now, clearly, it's important to understand why these widely varying financial firms were acting like traditional banks. Moreover, I think most of us would agree that when systemically risky financial firms take on the role of banks, they should face the same kind of prudential regulation as do banks. But we must pause here and ask ourselves, if all major sources of financing today are to be treated as banks with more or less of a one-size-fits-all capital requirement and conservative risk measurement mandate, where is the financing to come for the next wave of high-risk, high-payoff innovations? Who will finance the next great development in transportation, or medicine, or artificial intelligence? If we look back at the many fundamental economic innovations of the 20th century, aircrafts, antibiotics, the internet, the transistor and semiconductor, the mass-produced automobile, and the plastics that Mr. McGuire told us to invest in the movie The Graduate, we see relatively little bank financing, at least not at the inception of each innovative life cycle. This is unsurprising because, as we know, banks are the archetype of systemically risky financial entities. Consequently, bank regulation, when it's done properly, imposes a certain degree of financial conservatism. This is where the traditional tools of the securities regulator come into play. While banking regulation is designed to control and, to a certain extent, suppress risk-taking, securities regulation, in stark contrast, is designed to facilitate it. In the financing of economic pursuits that entail substantial risk, the traditional tools of securities regulators, that is, disclosure, transparency, and rigorous enforcement efforts to police fraud and abuse, have a substantial comparative advantage over banking regulatory tools. As mentioned earlier, failure is an essential part of the innovative process, but that is precisely what banks should try to avoid. Capital markets play a very different role in our financial markets. Capital markets, and by this I mean both the public and private markets, are places where the large risks are financed. Failure is commonplace and accounted for in the cost of capital. Consequently, the issue that keeps securities regulators up at night isn't necessarily contagion in the banking sense, where concerns about the solvency of one firm leads to a run on otherwise solvent firms, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of bank failures. It's not concern about faith in the stability of the system, where stability means solvency and capital adequacy. Rather, what keeps us securities regulators up at night are fears about a widespread loss of faith in the integrity of the market. That is, a loss of investor confidence. Investor confidence in a market's integrity is central to the integrity of the overarching financial system, but integrity and investor confidence mean very different things to securities regulators than financial market integrity might mean for a banking supervisor. Risk itself is not necessarily a problem. It's not so much that investors might fear that a particular issuer isn't as healthy as they previously thought. It is not so much that investors don't happen to be winning. That occurs every day. No, the problems arise when investors begin to think that the market is a rigged game that they cannot win. So now turning to the topic of FCP enforcement. Let me shift gears and talk not so much about regulatory trends and regulatory convergence, but talk about cross-border cooperation. The FCPA is by its very nature an international matter, whether it is because the evidence is located abroad or because the case almost invariably involves a violation of another jurisdiction's laws as well as your own. And thus, there will be other authorities involved. And the preferred way that this involvement takes place, from all of our perspectives, is cooperation. Let me describe what this cooperation can be like through a cinematic example. I have a passion for cinema. And to the surprise of some who know my background, I enjoy the classic American Western. One of my all-time favorite Westerns is a movie called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, starring the great American actor, Jimmy Stewart, and that icon of the American Western, John Wayne. Why do I enjoy this movie so much? First, It has all the elements of a great Western: a stoic hero, a disreputable villain, stagecoach robberies, barroom brawls, and the inevitable showdown, a gunfight in the street. But perhaps I like it so much because the apparent hero of this film is actually not the stoic gunfighter. It is instead a young lawyer carrying a bag full of law books instead of a gun. The movie also happens to provide a telling lesson about responding to the challenges of regulating the global capital markets. For those of you who haven't seen the film, let me give you a quick synopsis. The movie opens with our young lawyer, played by Jimmy Stewart, traveling from out east with a seemingly naive intention of bringing law to the frontier. However, before reaching his destination, he is savagely beaten and robbed when his stagecoach is ambushed by a band of outlaws. Luckily, he is found by the John Wayne character, a hard-bitten, sharp-shooting cowboy, and brought to a little town where he's nursed back to health. He soon finds out the facts. The leader of the outlaws is a notorious thug and killer by the name of Liberty Valance. John Wayne, who our young lawyer befriends, turns out to be the protector of the town and the one man tough enough to stand up to Liberty Valance. The young lawyer sets out to establish a rule of law on the frontier. He's eventually challenged to a showdown in the street by a drunken Liberty Valance. Although opposed to settling disputes by violence, as well as being ignorant of guns, he steps out to meet his antagonist and his apparent doom. They face off. Both men fire their pistols. Surprisingly, despite his skill as a gunfighter, it is Liberty Valance who falls dead in the street. Our young lawyer is a hero. He's universally applauded as the man who shot Liberty Valance, and this fame helps him get elected to positions of great authority, governor, senator, etc. And he is instrumental in ushering in the rule of law to the frontier. Considering that I myself am a lawyer from out east, you can perhaps see why I like this film as much as I do. But what we are witnessing today with the interconnection of markets is nothing less than the opening of a new frontier. It is true that our capital markets have always had an international component and that cross-border transactions have always been with us. But it is the exponential advances in computer and telecommunications technologies that have the potential to virtually eliminate the boundaries between markets. The internet and communication technologies, much like the railroad that ran through far-flung Western towns of a century and a half ago, herald the potential creation of wealth and progress by connecting formerly isolated outposts and markets. Today, virtually any trader, broker, or business, no matter the location, can conduct a transaction a half world away with a click of a computer mouse. The promises of this new frontier are many. These promises include lower transaction costs, greater choice, and greater competition among financial service providers to the benefit of investors and issuers alike. As I mentioned earlier, these ever deeper and more liquid capital markets can now be directed to where it'll be used more efficiently, or the capital can. At the innovators who drive our economy, issuers have the ability to seek capital at the lowest cost wherever it may be. Investors can now diversify their portfolio risks across borders more effectively and at less cost than ever before. All these things being equal, and all things being equal, modern economic theory suggests that such investment diversity is wise. However, all things are not equal. For one, in the United States, cross-border trading entails higher costs because foreign financial services providers cannot solicit U.S. investors unless they're regulated by the SEC. The result is that U.S. investors bear the costs of the intermediation by both a U.S. broker and a foreign broker that actually executes the trade for them abroad. All things are not equal also because this new frontier presents risks. As we all know, all too well, as national markets become integrated, global risks become domestic risks. The cross-border consequences of the subprime crisis are evidence of that fact. And just like in our film, bandits, not unlike Liberty Valance, ply the borderlands, and these modern-day bandits rob and defraud investors, not with guns, but by employing the same technologies used by legitimate multinational businesses and financial service providers. And as in the Wild West, we find snake oil salesmen plying their wares in our markets, foisting worthless or dangerous products on us unsuspecting customers, bribing corrupt government officials, and stealing business from honest shopkeepers. There is, of course, already law in the global capital markets, enacted in our individual jurisdictions and enforced by us, the regulators, which are designed to combat fraud and regulate sales practice. This is not unlike the situation faced by the young lawyer in our film. He discovered that those living on the frontier had a code. This code emphasized autonomy, strength, and individual action. It distrusted outside interference. And just as that code was not meant for a world of commerce and the railroad, the SEC's traditional approach to cross-border enforcement was devised when the world was a different place. Our approach was designed for markets that were self-contained and isolated from the outside world. So, how should regulators contend with this new frontier? What can we do? All the risks I describe can work to make this frontier a pretty scary place. One approach for dealing with this new environment is continued isolation. We can try to seal our borders, much like the sheriffs of old. We could require all strangers to check in upon arrival, and we can insist that all entities, whether foreign or domestic, providing financial services or products, come fully under our regulatory control in every detail. We might also be tempted to open up the gates, let in everyone who wishes to do business with our citizens, declare caveat emptor, and accept the ensuing race to the bottom. Neither of these approaches is economically efficient. And in the case of the SEC, I believe our mandate makes both approaches difficult, if not impossible. The SEC is charged with three overarching goals: protecting investors, making sure our markets are fair, orderly, and efficient, and promoting capital formation. Protecting investors from fraud while assuring them that they are getting the best investment opportunities available and the broadest array of information upon which to base their choices is a challenge. Opening our markets indiscriminately or keeping our investors locked at home does not achieve any of these goals. International collaboration is a third, better alternative. Many of you might be wondering about the ending of the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, so indulge me. You might be asking yourself, how could our naive young lawyer, a man who had never held a gun in his life, have beaten a notorious gunfighter like Liberty Valance? You appropriately would question my artistic and literary sensibilities if I were to enjoy a movie with such a cliched and hackneyed ending. The answer is that our young lawyer didn't kill Liberty Valance. This is the hook that makes this movie great and teaches a valuable lesson. What we learn is that Liberty Valance was actually killed by a shadowy figure at the end of the street. Just as the two men raise their pistols and Liberty is about to end our young lawyer's life, John Wayne, hidden from view, shoots Liberty Valance. You see, John Wayne realizes that for his town to advance and for his citizens to prosper, he needed the help of the young lawyer. Although he knew it meant he would become less central to the town, he decides to cooperate with the young lawyer to remove the barriers to a new, more efficient legal order. In short, this past decade has seen a tectonic shift in how securities regulators combat cross-border financial crime. In a sense, we have now adopted a philosophy whereby the collective security of securities regulators is what we're after. In this philosophy, we have the authority to view a threat to the integrity of foreign markets as a threat to our own. Those who commit financial crimes can run across borders, but they can't hide. And we have arrangements like MOUs and the multilateral MOU that IOSCO has put together that help us actually police collectively together threats to our individual markets, which amount to a threat to all markets. And this sense of the collective has also led to joint investigations, has led to leveraging of resources, and has led to complementary rather than duplicative remedies for wrongdoing to the benefit of governments, to the benefit of market participants, and to the benefit of justice overall. Why don't I stop there and see if people have questions. Thank you.